Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 422, we bring you the preview of the March 2024 edition of Retinal Physician. Retinal Physician can be found in print and online for free at retinalphysician.com. For this episode, we are focusing on geographic atrophy and age-related macular degeneration. Thanks again to my colleagues for joining me for this episode. And remember, listeners, you can find a list of financial disclosures in the episode description.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is back with a preview of the March 2024 edition of Retinal Physician. Joining me for this podcast, three of my colleagues from around the country. First in alphabetical order, Dr. Kat Talcott's in Cleveland, Ohio. Kat, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
I have Dr. Akshay Thomas. He's in Nashville, Tennessee. Akshay, welcome.
How's it going, Jay?
And I got Dr. Sarwar Zahid in New York.
Thanks, Jay. Well, great to be back.
So the way these RP previews work, if you're first time listening, these are all available for free and online at retinalphysician.com. We're not going to spend a lot of exhausted time summarizing the articles, just talk about some key points. And then what we're going to try to do is use them as jumping off points for discussion. So the first article I wanted to talk about was called Cost Effectiveness of Early Detection of Wet AMD. This is by Samantar Joshi, Ken Nguyen, Karen Y, and San Rahimi, all of Stanford. And again, summary is they talk about, just as for many diseases, maybe you could reduce costs by detecting AMD earlier. They go through some of the data about how much AMD costs due to treatment. And they talk about the cost effectiveness of different ways of doing this, such as FA, OCT office visits, you know, and the limitations of some of the computer simulation studies that have looked at the cost analysis here. And they specifically spend some time talking about the study from Hernandez et al., where they're really looking at the qualies of five different index tests. And quality is this term, quality adjusted life years, is kind of a measure that's used for see how much utility a treatment has, and then you use it for cost analyses, to how much quality are you adding per cost. And they looked at simulated patients to look at how you can detect AMD. And the highest quality was actually from spectral domain OCT, which was followed very closely by fundus assessment, Amsler grid, subjective vision, and visual acuity. OCT was pretty low cost just because it's very, very highly sensitive for detection. So they tie this into the idea of home monitoring, you know, and how you could sort of justify costs in the future. And home monitoring, I think we all understand anecdotally, it's probably cost effective and it makes sense. But it's kind of interesting to see some of the numbers put in paper here about how it would actually work. There are limitations to these computer models that they talk about. But Kat, I'll let you start. I mean, this was interesting to me because I didn't see that original paper when it came out. So it's good to see a summary of it and see a discussion of it. I think it can quantify things maybe we already know. If there's anything that surprised you about this analysis, and do you think, again, there really isn't an argument against home monitoring. I guess all that is there is, again, how much will it cost? And the second is, how do you sort of make it actionable, where if someone does have a problem, how do they get treated?
Yeah, I think those are really good points. And I really like this article summarizes something that I think we think about in clinic a lot, right? These are types of questions that like residents and fellows ask, but it's actually like pretty hard to study. I agree with you. I think it's nice to see that there is some validation for home monitoring. I think I have questions about, you know, if we're to have a system like home OCT, you know, it makes sense from a cost effectiveness standpoint. One of the questions I have is like, how are we going to be able to get those patients in though right away and have access to them if there's a problem? I think one of the other things that I was sort of struck by with this article, which kind of reaffirmed things, is the utility or the cost effectiveness of doing FA for wet AMD. I realize when some of my fellows asked me about this, I basically just don't really rely on FA for determining if there's a CNV or wet AMD, because I just think it's not always super obvious in these cases where people have CSR or not. So it was nice to see that affirmed, that really OCT is, you know, our workhorse, and that sort of validates at least what I feel like in my practice. But I'm curious to hear what everyone else thinks about this article. It's interesting for sure.
What do you think, Akshay?
Yeah, I agree, especially that last point, because I think they often reference in this article, like fluorescein angiography being the gold standard for, you know, wet exudation in wet AMD. And I honestly can't think of the last time I ordered an FA specifically on a patient with wet AMD. I feel like if I can't really clearly detect something on OCT, I doubt my FA is going to add a whole lot. And I think even in this cost analysis, this quality analysis, they were, you know, saying that using OCT reduced, you know, the number of FAs you needed over a year from like 5 to 3. And I'm like, I can't really think of the last time I've been more than like one FA on a patient than a patient with, you know, like higher rate, like severe NPDR. So it's definitely probably pointing towards a paradigm shift, which probably a lot of us, you know, in the OCT era already know exists, where we kind of rely on OCT for most of our detection in wet AMD, but it's nice to see it kind of confirmed in a study like this.
Sarwar, do you have any other thoughts or points about the idea of home monitoring?
Yeah, I completely agree with both of you. I'll mirror what you guys said about FA. I never do FA for neovascular AMD, because I mean, if you're able to see a net on a fluorescein angiogram, you're going to be able to see a vascular PED at a very minimum on an OCT. The other interesting thing is, you know, I mean, a lot of us, I mean, for example, at my office, I have an Optos FA, but I remember the quality of the FA on the Heidelberg. I mean, you know, nothing against Optos, but the quality of the image, especially if we're picking up subtle occult neovascular membranes, as we did in the old AMD studies, that's a little harder when you're looking at a wide field image. The last thing about home monitoring that I thought was super interesting is, at what point do you start monitoring? Because if as a system we need to be cost effective, you know, if when you think about the studies back in the day trying to determine when breast cancer screening, when colonoscopy screening should start, that was done on large studies to determine the cost effectiveness. And, you know, if you just screen everyone, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You may actually be adding to the cost, because many patients don't lose vision or don't convert to neovascular AMD. So I think, you know, this paper mentioned the idea of using the home monitoring for people who are deemed high risk. So we can do this clinically. And there are so many tools now that are being developed. We talk about AI, and there's so many papers about AI and deep learning to help us determine which patients are at highest risk. So I think we haven't figured that out yet, but I think, you know, that's a really good start.
Let's tie it into the discussion of, you know, one of the reasons there's so much interest in detection is now, and it's not just about detecting wet AMD, now you can detect dry AMD. And obviously we have treatment now for advanced dry AMD with GA, but the idea would be we want to move towards a time where we can treat patients even earlier. And then early detection, earlier treatment, you reduce costs, kind of tying into the point of this article. Karen Jagmiller wrote this article on her own about considerations in management of dry AMD, and talks about counseling, which I think is like the buzzword. Everyone talks about counseling because there's a lot of chair time involved in having these discussions. And again, to summarize some of the big points from this article, they talk about indications from the FDA for treatment with pegcetacoplan or SYFOPRI, Avastin, Captid, Pegol. I can't say it 5 times fast, but that's how we pronounce it. Izervay, the C3 and C5 complement inhibitor for GA. She talks a little about patient counseling. And I think, you know, the big points from counseling, again, is patients need to understand it does not result in visual improvement. They need to understand it's slowing progression. They need to understand it is a commitment to treatment. They don't have to. They're not signing on a dotted line. They have to do it forever. But if it's going to have effect, it's generally you have to continue treatment over time. And then I thought the interesting part was talking about concurrent treatment, which is a fascinating discussion a lot of us have had, is what do you do if someone has concurrent wet and GA? Do you treat one? Do you treat both? How do you manage that? I mean, I just came off a call of an episode that will release after this one with Phil Rosenfeld. So this is like a sneak peek. And he had a really fascinating thoughts about what he thinks about the risk profile of stacking drugs in the same eye once you start dealing with this. So we go to our uveitis and vasculitis specialist, Akshay Thomas. You know, Akshay, one of the things that has to be talked about in counseling of any new drug is potential risk. One of the things that we are concerned about is IOI and vasculitis. And with SYFOVRE or Pelas, there's recently been updates released, there are cases reported of vasculitis. But then we have some comparative data shown in angiogenesis that shows probably there may be more benefit with SYFOVRE over IZERVAY. Again, not maybe apples to apples, but they try to make those trial comparisons as apples to apples as possible. How do you approach your uveitis specialist? You always want to see the FAs, and we don't know if the FAs for all those patients, but how do you approach the chair time now in terms of risks, right? And do you modify your counseling and or your treatment strategy now, knowing that vasculitis is a rare but possible complication?
Yeah, I'd say the one, so of course, just like everyone I include in my discussion, it's good to have a little bit more clarity on what the true incidence is now that we have better data on actually how many patients have been treated, not just how many vials have been kind of dispensed, so to speak. And the other part, which is helpful, is knowing that these cases are occurring after the initial injection. So I think, you know, being able to say that at least as of now, risk of, you know, devastating vision loss from inflammation is really after that first injection. A way that I probably incorporate into practice is if I have a patient that has, you know, non-central GA in one eye that I'm trying to preserve vision, and the fellow eye has advanced central GA that I wouldn't inject normally, I'd probably inject that bad eye first, really as just like a test eye to kind of see how they did. And if they didn't get inflammation in that eye, then I would subsequently offer treatment in their fellow eye, the only eye that I'll treat moving forward. Mm-hmm. But I think, again, it just, it's really, you know, I think the part that I really harp on with my patients is I really don't feel like I talk any patients into treatment for GA. I feel like I kind of give them the information and let them decide if it's something they want to do. You know, after discussing all the risks we talked about, secondary, you know, increased risk of CNV, inflammation, so on and so forth. And the lack of, you know, any improved visual functional metrics, at least at 2 years. So if a patient is really motivated and understands that they want to do that, then I will go ahead and do it. But I certainly don't have patients that I feel like I'm talking them into doing it.
Can I ask a question? And actually, you can answer this. I don't want to put you on the spot. Kat, you could also maybe answer this and only maybe raise your hand if you want to answer this. How much time on average do these conversations take? That's something that people who aren't treating ask me. How much time do these conversations take? What are you billing a higher level of complexity when you bill for these visits than normal because of the chair time it takes? How do you handle that? I don't know if either of you wants to take that question. Kat?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think the chair time is a lot here. And I totally agree with Akshay that this is not something you want to go talking patients into because it's a very nuanced decision about whether or not to proceed. And even if you convince someone to get an injection once, like keeping up with the treatment, even though they're not noticing an improvement in their vision, is going to be really hard. So you really want to make sure that the patient sort of has their own motivation. I think the chair time is a lot. I try and break it. I've tried to break it up over visits, like knowing that these treatments are coming. I've tried to, if I think someone's a good candidate, be talking about it a couple times, you know, like over multiple visits. But I feel like I spend like a good 10 or 15 minutes with these patients, which is a lot in a busy clinic day. I don't actually bill more aggressively. You probably could. I'm not in a system that actually like rewards that either. So I just, but it is, it adds to my day.
I'm in a system where we don't even submit codes. So that's why I'm asking you guys anymore. I'm at the bottom of the barrel now. So Sara, what do you think?
I think these are really long conversations. I have not started using these medications, but I have a list of patients that I talk to every single time. What's tough is some of these patients are a little bit older, right? This is an older population. What I've noticed is I mentioned I go over everything with them. I give them the literature. There's some very helpful literature from Iveric and Apellis that I give to the patients. Go talk to your family members. You know, this is something that we need to talk about. It's a commitment, you know, because we don't know what happens if you stop these medications, right? I mean, that's something we won't have the answers to for years, because there will be patients where you stop the medication and there are going to be follow-up studies that may show that the rate goes up, you know, so we don't know. So to get that commitment, I ask patients to follow up, you know, in a couple of months after discussion with their family. Oftentimes they have to repeat the same discussion. So it's been tough, because a lot of patients actually don't like the commitment, especially when I mention to them that, look, our goal is the vision that we've lost, we may not get back. And it does not eliminate the risk of vision loss. It just slows it down. And I try to give all the examples of glaucoma and, you know, diabetes, high blood pressure, other chronic diseases. But the idea, especially for patients who've never gotten injections before, it's been a tougher sell. And honestly, I've actually started talking to patients who are actually, you know, fovea involving, like 2100, 2150, 2200, but those lesions can expand. I mean, there's a difference between 2200 and count fingers. So I don't think those patients are a bad candidate. That's the interesting thing. The one more point I'll make about this specific article is that the considerations for bilateral injections, I mean, if you talk to a lot of people in private practice and so, especially in smaller groups, it is financially disadvantageous to do bilateral injections. You know, obviously there's the whole issue with reimbursements for medications, but you know, that can be a consideration, and that should never be the primary consideration, because our primary job, you know, I do bilateral injections because it's easier for the patients and their families. But, you know, especially, you know, if you're starting a new business, you have to pay your employees. It's something to think about. Last thing is these are really long drug names for the generic names, but you heard it here first. It's Peggy and Ava. That's what we're going to call it from here on out.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I don't know what I don't even know what to say to that. Very rarely speechless on this program, and I just don't really know what to say right now. I just want to let that marinate a little bit. You know, the funny thing is, you said that, now I forgot about the thing I was going to ask about what you said before. Now my mind is blown. Let's tie it in the next articles. Yasha Modi, Vaide Denania, Natalia Cotton, all great rent specials in New York. Your neighbors there, Sarwar, they wrote about long-term data and GA, talking about two-year AVA data, the three-year PEGI data. It sounds weird. I don't know if I can keep doing this. And some of this was presented. And so, you know, it's a little bit of opinion. They talk a little bit about, you know, the counseling towards the end, who they treat, not treat, et cetera. I think the fascinating part, and Kat, I'll go back to you, the choice, right? How do you choose? If the payers don't dictate to you, and the patient's like, hey, if I'm your mom, what do you choose? It seems like Syfovre compared to Izervay, if you believe the comparative data, and some people poo-poo it saying they're not comparing apples to apples. Other people, like Phil Rosenfeld, who talked about this in the other episode, he's like, you know, they did a pretty good job sort of trying to find similar patients and line them up. They're convinced that Syfovre may be more efficacious than Izervay. However, you have some risks that have been reported rarely with Syfovre. We just haven't had enough patients get Izervay to see those risks, but let's say, I mean, I feel like everything in retina is all about choices between imperfect options. That's what makes it interesting. Let's say you have one option that is more efficacious, but carries a rare risk. And the other one is not as efficacious, but does not carry that risk. How do you make a choice? What do you tell patients? And like Alex said, usually you're not forcing them into it, but if they're interested, they're going to be like, which of these two options do I pick? So what do you think about that conversation?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. So I'm at an institution, and as you can imagine, it takes us a long time to get any medicines approved. But I've sort of asked this of like other people that were like early utilizers of it. And it really seems to be like, when most people are using these medications, it depended on when you got access to it, right? So if you had access early, you were using Syfovre. And then if you didn't get access to anything until the safety stuff came out last summer, then other people were using Izervay. And then once you got comfortable using one thing, it sounds like most people are
Just stay with it. Right.
Yeah, one or the other.
Which is true for anti-VEGF too, which is why the drug companies are so keen, you know, to kind of gain your market share. It's like a brand thing. It's like you start buying, you know, Jif peanut butter, and you're not going to buy Skippy because you just keep buying Jif because it's at the grocery and you pick it up off the shelf. I'm not trying to make it that, like, it's not that silly. People think about it, but once you start using something, you just keep using it.
No, I think it's very true. And even among the anti-VEGF agents, I was at a conference recently, and I was talking to some specialists, but also just comprehensive people who do injections. And the other thing that I was really struck by is people's loyalty and decision about which injection to use really also relies upon the relationship with their rep and who they feel better supported by. That there's actually a lot of, you know, people feel strongly there, that they have a relationship, they can trust someone, and then that dictates their product. From a data perspective, from my perspective, I think it's really hard to know which is more efficacious. I mean, this is already sort of, you know, as Akshay said earlier, we're not seeing functional benefit at 2 years. There's a lot of, you know, the data is very nuanced. I just think it's really hard to compare efficacy at this point. But I definitely echo what you guys have said that, like, the consensus that I've heard from more people is that there's a camp of people who believe that Syfovre is more efficacious. But I don't know if I buy that based on the data personally.
So what do you think about the choice? I mean, Kat brought up a lot of interesting points that, you know, we recognize: brand loyalty, being supported by your rep, liking your rep. I mean, that's the reason that they want to hire. I mean, I like reps too. And it does matter to me, because if I have a problem, I want to know that someone's going to help me out with it. I'm not stuck with a problem. How do you decide? What would you tell if your uncle called you and say, hey, I have these two options, which one should I use?
I think we're all in the same boat. It just depended. The data shows improvement, you know, and it depends on what your personal preference is. I think many people, you know, as Kat mentioned, moved over to Iveric Bio because of the vasculitis challenges. I think what's going to really turn the tide, I mean, we've been talking about these medications for a few years now, and this is hopefully the first iteration. You know, Yasha, I mean, these are all my amazing New York City colleagues. Tali's a co-resident. Yasha was your co-resident, Jay, and he's awesome. He's an attending of mine, and they're amazing. And one thing that they mentioned that I think is important is we don't know that it's working except from the passage of time, right? You know, it's just, you know, you won't know, even know from in 6 months if the rate has changed, because we need better tools to be able to actually detect and monitor. I mean, I can't be sitting there like measuring out the hyperreflective transmission over the course of 2 years when I'm counseling a patient. These discussions take about, you know, 7 to 10 minutes, which is a lot of time in a busy clinic day. But I think the challenge is we need a better way to detect that these medications are working, whether that is a better algorithm to detect a change in hyper autofluorescence pattern after the initiation of these medications. But I think it's the preference pattern is going to be dictated by what actually shows quantifiable objective changes. You know, why do we use certain glaucoma medications over, you know, and all those glaucoma studies? Because we can show over the course of many years that there's a quantifiable change. And I think that's one of the hardest parts of this disease. I have not started using these medications yet because I have a more diabetic heavy population. But, you know, I honestly personally don't have a preference. You know, I mean, I have good relationships with the MSLs from both these companies. They're great. But I don't know which one I would pick, you know. If you asked me 6 months ago, I think all of us would have said, you know, well, I would have said I'm gonna use the Iveric medication after there's a J code until I feel better about Syfovre. But you know, we have a little bit more data now, so I don't know which way I'd go, to be honest.
Akshay, can you be the tie-breaking vote between everyone saying they don't know? Because I don't know either.
Well, I'll preface this by any patient that I have coming in with GA, I have a discussion of these agents, in all honesty, not because I want them to be started on it, just so I feel like I've done them the justice of saying, hey, these are treatments we have available. I'm not necessarily saying I recommend this, but just an FYI, and you can look it up and decide if you want to do it or not. That being said, at this point, I still tend to use more Syfovre strictly because of the amount that has been out for about a year. We probably have a little bit more data on those rare side effects, even if there are, you know, there's purportedly a higher vasculitis risk than Izervay. You know, there may be a case lingering out there of a patient that had Syfovre in one eye and vasculitis in the other eye with Izervay as well. So have to wait and see. So it's really just a numbers game. There's probably more vials that have been injected. We have more data on it in the real world. And so I feel more comfortable using it at this point in time.
So the last article we're going to cover, we can continue this conversation because it's also about GA. Robin Geimer and team talked about imaging features that portend development of GA. And again, it's funny because Phil Rosenfeld and I have, this is a big topic of angiogenesis. And he and I just talked about this maybe 2 hours ago and it'll come out in a week given the time. The weird time dilation that happens in the podcast world where you record things the same day, but they happen in time for the listeners weeks later. But I mean, essentially, they go through some of the things I've discussed before, iRORA, cRORA, the things that are potentially endpoints that tell you that this patient's going to end up having GA, which patients are highest risk for GA. And one of the big take points of having a robust endpoint, to call that robust endpoint, is you want to have something that is consistent. You want to have something that graders can agree on. You want to have something that ultimately is going to be accurate, right? It was interesting to hear the term robust endpoint, but that's where it's basically a useful endpoint. It's something that you can utilize for trials. You can utilize it for drug testing, and you can utilize it hopefully down the line in your clinic to make decisions if and when we have treatment to treat these patients who are the highest risk, right? So you can risk stratify, and so you don't have to treat every patient with a drusen in your clinic with drug X that comes out in the future. You could pick the patients who are the highest risk and offer them treatment and none of the risks that may be rarely associated with treatment, right? So actually, we'll kind of wheel back here. Here's my zag, my hot take question. Do you think the market in GA is large enough to support two drugs at this point? Do you think, like, GA is obviously a huge drug, but it is just the tip of the iceberg for dry AMD. Do you think, that it is going to continue? Do you think they are going to try to expand indication, I guess is my question? Because if you expanded the indication at some point to treat patients who are highest risk for GA, not just GA extrafoveal or foveal involving, all of a sudden the market goes from, you know, 1% to way up, right, in terms of patients who could be treated. That would seem to be the more logical way for somewhere to go. And then the question is the investment in a trial like that, right? Is someone going to invest in doing a trial? Because it seems to be the patients you catch earlier are going to do better. But to show benefit, you would need something to sit. You would really want to capture the high risk patients, because if you capture the low risk patients, your control group isn't going to move either. So you actually have to capture the high risk group so that you can show a difference between drug and control over time.
So I think probably the easiest analogy we could make is to approval of medications treat NPDR, right? I mean, how many of us actually use our anti-VEGF injections strictly for NPDR, even if we have data that it might, you know, halt progression of PDR? I don't have a single patient I've used that in. The one situation in which I would say I would consider using an agent like that for that market is if we had some port delivery equivalent. Like we had a medication that you could fill and, you know, they need a refill once a year or something like that, right? So that would be a situation where I would consider, you know, intervening in someone very early. Would I start injecting someone every 2 months if they had nascent GA? Most definitely not. Most definitely not. But I would at least consider some long-acting therapeutic or an oral medication, you know, that's of probably minimal risk and minimal commitment for the patient over every two-month injection.
Yeah. Sarwar, any thoughts on that? I mean, I guess this is like the famous question. If you went to a bunch of patients and asked them, to Akshay's point, would you rather take a pill? Would you rather get a shot with X amount of frequency? Would you rather take eye drops? What would they pick? You know, what's the ideal? The ideal is one and done. But if you can't get one and done, what do you think the future in this space is? Because really, that's the most interesting thing from the imaging standpoint is, because I can identify the patients at highest risk, but I can't treat them. I'm just watching them to wait for them to get GA. And as soon as they get GA, I'm like, okay, I'm going to start treatment. But ideally, you would start treating those patients, right? If you know that they're the ones who are going to progress.
This is why this article was, was fascinating to me, because, you know, it highlights the fact that in order to get reliable biomarkers to show actual change, you need large numbers and a long duration of time to capture change. So I think that's what's really hard. The market is actually huge. I mean, we know about the aging population, but most of macular degeneration is the dry type. So, you know, we recently, in a prior journal club, we went over an AI study that looked at the AREDS OCT databases and basically found, you know, the intermediate AMD patients that were most likely to progress to GA. And they actually nicely demonstrated, like, okay, this is not a black box. It's detecting these PEDs with these changes in the ellipsoid zone and RP above it. And that's what's causing the higher likelihood. Those patients are a higher likelihood to progress. So I think patients would be open to getting a shot in the eye every 1 to 2 years, but we have to, you know, we can't just say, oh, you know, you have a 25% risk of vision. I mean, you know, we have these risk benefit calculations all the time. I mean, if I have a 75% chance of not having that problem, you know, I may not necessarily go for every 1 to 2 month injection. Those risk benefit calculations are really tough. We don't have enough data to beyond the, you know, the annual conversion to wet AMD, the annual conversion to GA. So I think this the points highlighted in this paper, the specific OCT biomarkers, I thought were really interesting. I would like to see some of this, and I'm sure it's already being done by the great, you know, like doctors studying, you know, AI and imaging that we've discussed before. If we combine all these risk factors and, you know, apply it to a very large data set, you know, in a recent journal club, we talked about the need for data and, you know, in medical and surgical retina. So the problem is you need to have enough imaging and you need to have it standardized. You know, the problem is use different machines and the standardization
different
is
photographers,
the issue.
Yeah, different cuts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or I mean, a small cataract can affect the quality of your image, and that
exactly can
read out like an error, you know?
Kat, final thoughts on this paper and our GA discussion?
Yeah. I mean, I think both of you made really excellent points. I mean, I think it's easier to imagine an AMD population, especially intermediate AMD patients, being amenable to treatment than I think more than we have been with severe NPDR patients. Like if you had a medicine, like, you know, they're already on AREDS, could you give them an oral medicine to like prevent it? And then, you know, I think there's definitely room in the market still. There's other exciting stuff, I think, in the pipeline. I think Janssen has a study going on where they're doing a one-time intravitreal injection. You can imagine something like that being, you know, potentially like really attractive. But, you know, I think that the GA population is what it is, but if we better understand the intermediate AMD population and where people are headed, then that is a huge population. And as you know, our population continues to age, I mean, that's where the unmet need is. And I think we just need to better understand who of those progress and make it easier for us to figure that out and have better treatments. But it's a complicated space. It's a moving forward space. One of my fellows asked me in the OR today, you know, do you feel unethical enrolling people in GA studies with there being treatments that are currently approved? Which I thought was a really interesting question. It was like a PGY1 and a good question, but I think there's definitely still room in the field for improvement.
Yeah, and I would agree. I actually, his point, and maybe actually is right about this can be similar to moderate, severe MPDR in terms of people not adopting treatment. But I'm on your side, Kat. I think the reason that maybe there would be adoption is because it is an irreversibly blinding disease progressing. So, I mean, the question would be, how much would you have to see to say, I am going to start treatment? Now, actually, it's probably right. If you don't have good ways to stratify those patients, and probably we won't start it routinely because there'd be so many patients you'd have to treat with no obvious benefit, and there would be attrition over time. So again, if we had really good data that was just like, hey, this is the patient who's got the highest risk of progression, and sometimes the fellow eye would probably be the most indicative or helpful. And it also comes back to both your points, everyone's point about what's the risk benefit profile, whatever treatment you're doing, right? If it's just one-time treatment that doesn't have much risk, you're taking a pill or you're taking a pill every day, like AREDS, then I think most people would sign up for it, doctors and patients. If it's, hey, you need to do this surgery and you're only seeing eye, many doctors and patients might say, you know what, that, I know it may help, but that's too risky for my blood. So anyway, I appreciate you guys taking the time on a Friday afternoon, evening. Sorry to sell you out and reveal the lack of social lives among the foursome here on this podcast. But hopefully everyone has a good weekend plans coming. Thanks so much for talking about this edition of Retinal Physician, talking about GA with me. Kat, Akshay, Sarwar, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks, bud.
Talk soon, guys. Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Thanks to our team for joining us today. Listeners, remember you can listen to all of our episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's RETINAPodcast.com. There are 422 episodes there sorted by category. You can find us in the favorite app on your mobile device, whether it's your Android or Apple device. We're also on Twitter and on Facebook. Our Twitter is @RetinaPodcast, and you can reach us there or by emailing me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again to our whole production team, Drs. Justin Ma, Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Benincasa. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.